Hello, Raiders. Jake Stenzel, I'm your host, Jake and Gino Podcast, here with my co-host, the multi-family mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, best-line author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing good this morning, brother. How you doing?
Not letting you ruin it, man. Gotta get it going here, baby. So always make it happen, big man. Today's guest is a best-line author and founder of Lone Star Capital, but apparently he's in New York, so we're going to unpack that, and we didn't ruin it beforehand. As CEO, he drives the strategic growth of the firm, which has acquired over $500 million in multifamily real estate. So without further ado, Rob Beardsley, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to share more.
Hey, it's our pleasure. So we definitely want to hear, you know, the story, you know, about the firm, why you got started. And yeah, Gino is getting into the New York, Texas thing. I said, just hit record. Let's not do this twice. So jump in, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, thanks again for having me. And before we hit record, I was sharing a little bit more information and Jake had a confused look on his face and Gino was asking all sorts of questions. So
we here started we go. Machine gunning him.
Yeah. So to weave the story together, I was born and raised in California. My parents used to run a residential brokerage firm back in Silicon Valley. So I had a lot of tech influence coming from Silicon Valley. So I went to school for computer science in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon, thinking I would go into consulting or start, do a startup or something like that. But pretty much my freshman year of college, I got the real estate bug. I couldn't escape it. And I started reading Bigger Pockets, started listening to podcasts like yourselves, and so on and so forth. And then I was very fortunate to meet my business partner, Kent Petrakovsky, who, Gino, is a New Yorker and is born and raised. And so he didn't need to twist my arm whatsoever. I quickly fell in love with New York and moved across the country. We planted our flag and we became Lone Star Capital all the way in New York because at the time we had a mentor who owned a lot of property in Texas. And so for us, it just made the most sense to look at Texas as our target market. We acquired our first property in Houston and that just set things off. From there, it was the next year, another property, then the next year, another property. And then before you know it, we were acquiring 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 deals in a year. And we have just stayed focused and we've never looked back. So to answer your question, Jake, we've only ever owned property in Texas. And all we do is focus on multifamily.
Jake, I'll let you ask the next questions. I see you're chomping at the bit.
No,
there.
It's a
you're...
stupid question. Go ahead.
It is not. No, I learned in eighth grade that no question is stupid, Mr. Stenzel.
You want to really know where my brain's at right now?
I really want to know where your brain's
so
at.
So
right
is
now.
Lone Star Capital a New York or Texas LLC? Because it seems weird having Lone Star Capital if it's a New York firm. Well, which?
Well, why don't you guess?
It's got to be in Texas, right? Come on.
It's a New York LLC.
Fuck off. Are you serious?
I'm serious. I'm dead serious.
Dude, the world is just upside down these days. I don't know. That's the craziest shit I've ever heard, man. So, all right, fair enough.
So I'll get back to the same questions. And Rob, let's talk about the first deal. I mean, what would the first deal look like? How did you take it down? Did you have buy right, manage right, finance right? And my last question, I'm going to keep piggybacking on this, is do you still own that deal?
Yeah. So I think this is a great story because I've personally learned a lot of lessons from this experience, obviously it being our first deal. So the first deal that we acquired was actually a 261 unit multifamily property in Houston, Class C. And we acquired that deal in July of 2018. So I would say the timing was pretty good for that deal. Obviously rents were poised to grow for the following couple years and cap rates continue to compress as we headed into COVID and then beyond. So timing was good. We bought right. But the problem was it was our first deal. We didn't know.
It's a huge deal for your first deal.
Yeah. And it was a huge deal. And so I'm actually very grateful because if I knew more about just how hard it is to buy, finance, manage, I would have shied away from that opportunity and I would have ran the other direction. But being naive, being inexperienced, me and my business partner looked at each other and shrugged and we thought, well, how hard could this be? Let's go and raise $4.5 million. And so I am grateful for our naiveness because it pushed us into deep waters and put our backs against the wall. And I worked as hard as I had ever worked and forced myself to just make something happen that, like I said, knowing what I know today, I would have not put myself through that situation. So
you wouldn't have done the deal or you wouldn't have done that? You wouldn't have bid off that much in the beginning.
I wouldn't have done such a big deal. I would have gone the more conventional route of buy a single family, then a duplex, and then a triplex, and then a fourplex, then a 16 unit, right? But
it didn't ruin you, though.
It didn't ruin us. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Obviously, right. We made every mistake in the book. We were ill-prepared from pretty much every aspect. But I would say the most important aspects that we were ill-prepared for were the debt side, which is an obvious but a big one.
I mean, what do you do for debt on that one?
We actually did a bridge loan, and we neglected to prepare. We didn't know that we needed a cosigner and that we're not just going to be able to get a loan. We kind of thought, well, maybe we can just kind of squeak past the lender requirements and get a loan anyway. But we had to scramble last minute to find a loan guarantor. Obviously, we had to give more of the deal away than we wanted. And that was a painful but certainly worthwhile learning lesson. And then
I mean, it's your first deal. I mean, the key is learning here, right?
Yeah.
You want to make money, but I mean, you're looking to learn, obviously, in advance. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, my dad pushed that into my head. He said, for your first deal, it's worth it if you have to pay to do it, right? If I actually have to pay money to somebody else to get it done, it's
there's no greater MBA than that experience. You're actually going through a deal, learning what it takes. Like, there's nothing more valuable than that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the equity side was even harder. And the equity side is an eye-opening experience because coming from where my business partner and I came from, we didn't necessarily have a passion or even an understanding of marketing or of investor relations. We kind of thought that if you find a good deal, the money will come and that investors are an afterthought and that let's focus on the real estate. And boy, were we wrong, right? Because I'm sure you guys see this. Bad deals get funded every single day. So it really doesn't matter how good the deal is. It's all about your relationships and it's about digging the well before you're thirsty. And we didn't do that. We basically just spent no effort on marketing or investor relations. But then once the deal was under contract, that's when we started dialing for dollars. And as you guys both know, it's too late. So we scrambled and scrambled and really struggled to raise
money. So how did you get the money?
Similar to the loan guarantor, basically just being willing to bring on partners, being willing to give a lot of praying, a lot of soul searching, and being willing to give up big pieces of the deal in the short term for the bigger picture of building a business.
Growing the business.
Putting the door, right?
Rob, on that deal, what was the value add component on that deal? Or what were you able to do to increase the NOI in that property?
Well, that's definitely one of our saving graces because we bought at the right time, because we paid the right price, and because we had a good business plan, we were able to get away with making some of these major mistakes because we did have a good buy on our hands and we had a good business plan. We came in with about a $2 million renovation budget, a lot on the interior, a lot on the exterior. It was a tired property that KKR bought out of foreclosure in a 23 property portfolio. So KKR basically bought this big portfolio, took these deals from really bad to just pretty bad, and then were flipping out of them. And so we had a lot of meat on the bone. And we were able to actually take occupancy from basically 70% to above 90%. We were able to raise rents $100 plus, which at that time, people weren't getting the crazy $200, $300 rent premiums that they were in kind of the boom times of 2021 and 22. But yeah, that really helped a lot. And installing washer and dryers gave us a rent pop as well. And just cleaning up the crime and the curb appeal and the reputation, it was a rough area. So all those things led to a pretty substantial increase in income and value to the property.
Now, Rob, I can picture this. You're walking into the broker's office. You've got a nice jacket on, nice tie. You got gel in your hair. You're looking fresh, brother. But how does a young guy like that actually have the confidence, or have the broker have the confidence in yourself to take down your very first opportunity? Because most brokers would say, I'm not selling a deal to a young person who has no track record. And we hear this every day. And for anybody listening to this, you can't make that as an excuse now. Well, I don't have any deals. I don't have any credibility. Rob walks into an office with no deals, no credibility, and signs on 261 units. How'd you do it?
Yeah. And this is obviously very critical. And I'm going to give some perhaps practical advice and then kind of just some like woo-woo advice. And so the practical side is...
Wait, before you say that, time out. I like the woo-woo. Jake's likes the practical. You see his eyes light up when you said practical. He got really into the mic. He's like, I want to hear the practical. Leave that woo-woo shit for Gino. I'm sorry.
Perfect. No, you gotta have both. And so,
see, Jake? You got to have both, brother.
The practical side is you need to know your numbers and you need to be able to talk the talk. Right. And you guys know this, and you know that there's a broker speak, right? And you need to be able to talk their language because it signals that you know what you're talking about. You've been there before. So I'm not saying to be dishonest and say, oh, well, I've done such and such deals and stuff. I'm not saying talk that talk, but I am saying you need to be able to speak the language of NOI and of cap rate and all the stuff that might seem basic to experienced guys like yourselves. But when you're starting out, you might even be scared of using a term like debt service coverage ratio. I might use it wrong, right? So you need to have the confidence to know what you're talking about, because if you can't convince yourself, you're not going to be able to convince them. And that kind of goes to the next step of the woo-woo, which is simply confidence. And confidence speaks loudly and really does go a long way, because at the end of the day, a broker making a decision, it comes down to the relationship, it comes down to the price, comes down to the terms and certainty of execution. And I would say the certainty of execution one, really, you can talk the talk, you can be confident, but at the end of the day, if you're not putting up a hard deposit, depending on your market, of course, Texas is a hard deposit market, which means that if you're going to put a deal under contract, you're most likely going to put a deposit that is non-refundable the day you sign the contract. Of course, subject to a few outs. And that's exactly what we did, because I could talk the talk. I could say, well, believe in me and we're going to make this happen. And I'm going to bring in the partners and the help that I need. But at the end of the day, my business partner and I had to get comfortable with putting up a $300,000 non-refundable deposit. And
How impactful was that $300 or $300,000 to you at that point? Like, was that a lot of money to you at that point in your life?
It was. It was more money than I had, and so it was basically.
So where'd
like,
you get more money than you had then?
We borrowed it. well, praying alone did not work. We borrowed it. Some of it came from my parents. Some of it came from my business partner. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you guys don't know.
You have amazing parents, right? Holy shit.
You have no idea how amazing my parents are, but this is definitely a shining example. But my business partner, he's 17 years older than me, so he came with more corporate experience, more life experience. So he obviously I forgot to mention that part, but he brings a lot more gray hair and gravitas to the table.
Yeah. Wow. How'd the deal turn out?
So we ended up selling it in December of 2021. So we actually put it on the market in February of 2020. And then COVID came and basically no one was getting on a plane. We had no tours. We had to shelve the deal. And actually, I think we sold it in December of 2020, not 2021, but we ended up holding it for about 3.5 years. And then we sold it and we delivered a 21% IRR.
So I have to ask this question, Rob, would you consider now, knowing what you know, would you still be holding that asset right now, or was it the right time for you to sell? Obviously, you're in a syndication; you need to give back the capital to your investors. But how does that deal look today to you?
I think to me, just a simple answer is yes, it made sense to sell. But that question is definitely more complicated, especially when you're talking about syndications, because there's the LP desires, there's the GP desires, there's the fact that we were a brand new company and getting an exit under our belt was really, really full important. Cycle.
Yeah. Yes.
Many doors open up once you go full cycle.
But Rob, what was your desire? If you're looking back now, knowing what you know now, would it have been cool?
He's like, I got to get paid on something here, man. Let the money rain, baby.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just saying, like, as he goes down and he starts, like, we talk about the conveyor belt, starts stacking on more assets, maybe 5 years from now, you buy a very similar deal. Does your mindset change and say, hey, I want to hold this asset longer term?
I think it's a very fair point. And I think given that this was an 80s vintage C-class property with crime in the area and just a challenging demographic, I think the simple answer is
yes, I guess
selling makes sense when you, because those deals, and I don't mean to be pejorative to these deals, but these sorts of deals are hot potatoes and they're meant for trading and not holding. And that's just the reality of the situation. And if you can get in, create value and sell, it is probably in your best interest, because I don't want to make them sound like ticking time bombs, but you're talking about old property where roof issues, foundation issues, and if you're talking about rough demographics,
the plumbing, these deals is really never, where it gets challenging.
Yeah, plumbing,
you just start tearing stuff up. Yeah.
Yep. And the tenants beat up the property, so it's a lot of work. If you're the LP, it might not be such a bad thing to sit back and just collect a slightly higher cash on cash return because you're dealing with a rougher property, but as the GP, it's a lot more work.
Do you do the deal a day?
No.
You're not touching it. Why?
Would I do the deal today? I would say no for a couple reasons. One, we paid $15.4 million for it, And so today that is too small of a deal for us. We're trying to do 30 million plus today. And then I would also say that aside from that, I would say probably we would do the deal today. The biggest thing I'm afraid of is just the demographic and the challenge associated with trying to do a value add. So I think we're more cautious. We're more looking at things from a risk adjusted basis where sure, we could go in and make money, but what's our opportunity cost? Could we buy a 2000s deal that's much less risky and less of a headache and still make maybe a slightly lower return, but still decent return? That's the calculus that we go through nowadays.
And did you ever refi that deal or did you just let it float until you sold it?
Yeah. So when COVID hit and we realized that no one was getting on a plane to come tour our property and the world's ending, we're never going to be able to sell, we had a bridge loan. And that was not a comfortable situation to be in because we didn't know if people were going to pay their rent on April 1st of 2020, right? And it was a scramble. We had two bridge loans in the portfolio at that time, and we quickly moved to refining both of them. We got out of all bridge loans because we thought the world was going to end. And I can't say that was the wrong decision, but certainly I wish I would have seen that.
Because you had a hefty prepay, I'm guessing, on the sale. Is that what happened? Or?
Well, so the thing is we foresaw that issue. So we actually refied into Freddie floating rate loans.
Okay.
So we actually benefited from ultra low interest rates and the Fed lowering rates and SOFR at zero. So we had super low coupons and then we sold before those floating rates went up.
Before I ask my next question, I have to look up the word pejorative. I'm not really sure what that word means, but maybe Jake can tell me what that means. You know what pejorative means, Jake?
I don't know. It gets challenging. Like, is it PJ? Like, I don't even know how you'd spell something like that. It's more for a guy with a tie. Like, I'm just not executing on that one, all right?
Pejorative, expressing contempt or disapproval.
Okay, I got
is
you.
That, is that coming straight from the brain, or are you on, like, Wikipedia now or something?
No, I'm on the New Oxford American Dictionary.
Okay.
You know, because it's interesting what happened with you, and you've at least evolved. It was a function of the market cycle. You're buying a C property for a 7 or 8 cap and understanding that's where the pricing should be. It should be maybe an 8 cap where people were buying 4 caps, 1970s properties. A 4 cap 1970s property becomes a foreclosure. That's what ends up happening. So in this part of the market cycle, you're going to see 1970s and 80s. See, now Rob is not saying he's not going to buy those assets. He's going to buy those assets at a discount or at a valuation where it makes sense to really get the cap rate, you know, to compress it and to sell it. So he understands the market cycle. He understands what kind of assets to buy. And he said 2000s build right now. Well, Jake and I right now are currently closing on a 2018 build on Thursday. Next month, we're closing on a 2019 build. And in October, we're closing on a 2008 build. Because the valuation and the asset prices make sense there. We're not going to go and buy a 1970s build for a 5 cap. Why would I do that when I can buy a 2019 build for a 6 or 7 cap? It doesn't make sense. Do you want to, I guess, share your thoughts?
That?
Yeah, expand upon that because it's
not
important.
In a pejorative way or anything, but yeah.
Yeah. Let's not be pejorative here. So I think that's spot on. And this is what I love about one of the things I love about this business is we don't just show up to work every day with a hammer and just hit the nail away, right? We've got different tools in our tool belt and every day brings a new market. And so today it might make a lot of sense to do exactly what you guys are doing, which is buying newer vintage assets. And that's the same thing. A couple months ago now, we closed on a 2003 vintage. So not as nice and pretty and new as your 2018, but still, I would say like an A minus, very stabilized,
I love that age.
Clean deal. Yeah, it's a great vintage. And then in a couple months, we've got another deal closing that's 2004 vintage. So I totally agree with that strategy. But guess what? In 2025, when a lot of these foreclosure cycles happen and they take their course, buying 1970s deals might be the best play in the market because when it's not a matter of if, but
price,
when all
right?
the institutional capital floods back in, which is already starting to happen, right? Blackstone and everyone else is already starting to flood back in. What are they going to buy? They're going to be buying all the new stuff. So that stuff's going to run up in price. They're not going to be buying the 70s stuff. That's going to be hairy. So I think the market will change. It's not a one size fits all strategy.
Mm-hmm. Rob, you know, you use the strategy of praying and just hoping the money showed up.
You're using the praying, dude.
Well, I can see that he got on his knees and he said, where am I finding this money? That worked for the first deal. How have those systems evolved as far as raising capital now? Because you've been able, looking at deals of $30 million plus, you've obviously dialed in some of your systems for raising capital. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I love that question because it's so true, because you might be able to muscle, and you should muscle through your first raise or two because you have no other choice. But ideally, it sets you on a path, like it did for me, of building out a system, right? And that's what we did. We recognized, okay, money's not going to raise itself. We need to actually put a program in place. If you're not shouting from the rooftops about yourself, which is what marketing is, nobody's going to find you. So we started doing podcasts like this. I was very fortunate to stumble
into... You're in New York City, so you got some stuff going in Times Square, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. So, but on a real note, being in New York is incredibly valuable just from a networking perspective, mm-hmm. and meeting the right people and finding
investors
and things
like that.
He's
there as a vacuum, Gene. He's sucking the money to Texas.
He's hanging out with the Sal Buscemis of the world. That's what he's doing. He's hanging out with the right people, right? That's true.
That's what you got to do, right? That's why we pay this crazy rent here. So that, putting ourselves out there through networking events, through podcasts, through the books that we've published, articles. I started a newsletter and I started giving away our underwriting model for free, and that's been downloaded over 15,000 times now. So it's just steadily bringing more and more people into our network and just giving them value, right? And becoming a thought leader so that when they're ready and when we have the right deal for them, it's not as big of an ask. It's not a big bridge to cross, right? I don't have to sell them. It's like just kind of a quick check and they're in.
I love that. Before we go to the short answers, what has changed on the manage right portion of the framework? Because when you're buying 261 units and you have no idea that this truly is a business and it's operational, and operations at the end of the day is what really creates the value. Man, you can buy right, I get it, but you're making money in real estate, not when you're buying. You're making money on real estate when you exit, which is either through a sale or through a refinance. And how you exit successfully really depends upon the systems that you have implemented, whether you're using third party or you're using self-management yourself. So what did you learn? What have you implemented over the last few years?
Yeah, we recognized the challenges of management early on. And like most people, we started with third party management when we got started, but we quickly realized from our experience with third party, as well as from feedback from investors who are very savvy and seasoned, we understood the value and priority of self-managing your assets, because nobody cares like you care and nobody's going to be on top of it like you are. So we actually, when we hit around 800 units in our portfolio, we brought property management in-house. And
what year was this?
That was in I think it was in about 2020. Yeah, or 2021.
How did life change for you personally after that happened?
So I'll tell you, actually very funny, because at the time it was my business partner's responsibility to oversee the management side. So I know what you're getting at, but the reality is for me, I was on an island living life, having a good time. And so for me, it wasn't a big life changer, but it was certainly for my business partner. However, now we've shifted roles and I've taken over the management side as CEO. And yeah, it's a complete life changer. Like I mentioned before we hit record, currently I'm living at one of our apartment communities in a 3-bedroom unit, and I'm
now. How do the LPs feel about that? I'm sure you can make do with a 1-bedroom. You're living a little high on the hog there, Rob.
I was just about to make that joke. Sorry, LPs. So hopefully my 3-bedroom rent.
Or are you running the other two out to locals? Because then it would be really cool.
I'm running an Airbnb side business out inside of my multifamily syndication.
Shh, don't tell Freddie or Fannie that. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that stuff.
No, definitely not. So so that's being on the ground, there's no replacement for it, and we're getting super hands-on, because what we realized, and this is just like Gino said earlier, all about the growth and just learning as you go, is vertically integrating, meaning going from third-party management to self-managing, isn't a cure-all. It doesn't all of a sudden mean that, oh, well, now everything's going to be honky-dory. All it means is now that you are more in control of your own destiny. So you can be
you have another business to run now, too.
You do. And frankly, it's a business that is a thankless business. It doesn't make any money, right? The money is made, like Gino said, on the buy and on the sell, right? On the big things, when you're raising money and you're taking down big deals, that's what makes the money. The management is just what gets you there, and it's just what facilitates that opportunity. So it's thankless, but it's the most important. And another reason why I just mentioned that it's thankless is because you never really hear from tenants unless they're complaining, right? And you're never really hearing from your employees for the most part unless there's challenges and problems. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I said, it makes you in control of your own destiny, and you have the choice of making it a bad management company or a great management company. And so, you know, right now we're on a mission, we're on a crusade to make our management extremely great, and we're putting a lot of focus.
He was
going to
say make management great again. He was going That's there. Trump saying. Is make in his head. He couldn't even help it, but he had to back up.
No shame in that.
None whatsoever. Yeah, I 100% agree. But Rob, it's important. What you're doing is what Robert Martinez did. We had a podcast with Robert Martinez. Is he the apartment king, or he's in Houston in Texas as well? Rockstar. Rockstar. And he did the same thing. He's been in the business for a long time, and he took it to third party management. He saw the snafu and the issues that he was having, and then he brought it back to in-house management. He's got a great management system. He does some phenomenal things. And I thought he was listening to other people saying, I need to go out there and I need to raise capital and I need to be doing more deals. When in reality, even if you do a few less deals, but you are managing it yourself, there's a trade-off. But if you're managing it yourself and you're getting more profit per unit and you're getting more profitable exits and you're delivering superior quality to the employees that you have underneath you and to the residents, which is important. We always forget that the residents are our customers. And if we're not looking at them and we're just looking at them as a spreadsheet, you sort of lose the essence and the real reason of why you're in real estate. And I think that's important that you learn that lesson early on. And I think, you know, if anybody's listening to this, go listen to the Robert Martinez podcast we had with him a few months ago, because he shines the light on what he did wrong. He pulled it back and jumped back into, you know, self-managing, and he's turned the ship around pretty awesomely.
That's great to hear from him. Yeah, that's awesome.
All right, guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor. All right, we are back. So just got to close the door on this stain in the unit thing. So I guess you're getting very hands-on, working with the team, and it's available there to you, and there's probably no place closer while you're going to be in Texas than being on property. Is that the idea behind it, or...?
Yeah, we've got a bunch of desks set up in the living room, so it's not just me. I'm currently in New York because we're doing some workshops and meetings in the office here in the city. But on Monday, a bunch of us are heading down. So the three-bedroom is going to be well used. There's going to be five of us in the three-bedroom. And I'll have our investors know, before we upgraded to the three, we were in a two-bedroom, and there were five of us in a two-bedroom, one bath. So,
and it's not an upgraded unit. They're using one of the burnout ones. Okay, the stove barely works in the unit that they're in. So they're not taking a premium off the table here, okay?
Yeah, right? No owner's unit here with you know, all the fixings and upgrades.
So what's going on with management right now? You got five people going down. It sounds like you're working on some scale and some growth. Unpack that a little bit. There's obviously some sort of initiative behind this.
There is. There's a big restructuring happening with us. And it's starting from the top and it's going all the way down to the bottom. And when I say the bottom, I don't mean the bottom in that way. I mean the most important part of the business. I mean the front lines. And what we've recognized is that the most important person in our company, top to bottom, is not investor relations. It's not director of acquisitions. It's the community manager that sits at each and every property. They are the CEO. And which is why we're branding it the community executive officer, the CEO of each property. That's the most important person. And we've been going on a mission to recruit the best community executive officers, the best community managers at each property. And we're just empowering them to build the best on-site teams, because the easiest way to lose a tenant is with bad maintenance. The easiest way to lose a good condition of a property is bad maintenance. So you need to be able to hire, train, lead great maintenance teams. You need to have a good office team to obviously manage leasing, collections, etc. And it all starts with the community manager. And in order for us to be able to hire good community managers, we need to be down there. We need to be managing them and seeing how they work, and frankly learning from them, because we've now had the good fortune to hire some really amazing quality managers, and we're learning from them. And then we're able to have these workshops where we're sharing best practices across the portfolio, where we're getting all of our managers together with our asset managers as well. And we're just sharing ideas, implementing policies and procedures and best practices.
Are you guys doing maintenance managers, or are you doing maintenance coordinators, or a combination of both? How are you facilitating that?
each property has a maintenance supervisor.
Yeah.
And then depending on the size of the property, it will obviously have an assistant and a make ready, perhaps a porter, and that sort of schedule of a maintenance team. But we don't have any regional maintenance employees or managers.
Yeah, we're always looking, because we self-manage as well, and it's been my ambition from the beginning to replicate what Chick-fil-A did on the, you know, fast food side from a service perspective into our property management. And I share with our folks all the time, we're on a mission, you know, to be the Chick-fil-A of apartments. That's not any sort of thing that's written down, but it's the easiest way to communicate that to our folks. And so one of the things that we're looking at right now is also taking just not the maintenance manager, but what we're seeing is the probably the biggest issue is the breakdown in organization. And you can have a great, I think you're calling it community executive officer, right? But there's going to be also work there from an organizational standpoint that's got to connect with maintenance as well. And I think that's where that maintenance coordinator can kind of bridge that organizational gap to prevent snafus. And that's what we're looking at. It's one of our initiatives in the next quarter here is to implement this, you know, at scale throughout the 10 districts that we're running. And, you know, I think it's something you should definitely take a look at. We haven't implemented it yet, so I can't speak to it from an actual in-house experience yet, but I think there's something there. And I'm really interested to see how that plays out. I think you said you don't do anything at a regional maintenance level. So what do you take in house right now? Do you have, you know, in house flooring, HVAC, anything like that from like CapEx teams? Do you guys run anything like that, or are you planning and doing anything from that standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the skill level and the bandwidth of the on site team, they're able to perform various activities in house. Certainly HVAC is super important to be able to do in-house because you need to be able to do those repairs
quick. You can't run this
quick.
Business without being able to handle your own HVAC. It's yeah. Nearly impossible because the outside vendors will just steal from you. It's crazy. So,
and you need, so that's absolutely mandatory that the maintenance supervisor has an EPA certification so that they can work on all sorts of HVACs. And that's kind of one of the first questions we ask when we're interviewing maintenance supervisors. It's also required for them to have a CPO because, you know, there's no excuse to not have a sparkling blue pool, and the CPO is just a pool certification, and that's super easy to get. So speaking of getting certifications, it's something that we're in the process of rolling out, which is just like providing more training to our teams. And so that way, if they want to, if they're a porter or a maintenance tech and they don't have a certain certification, we want to invest in them. We want to pay the money for them to go and get those certifications so that they can be more valuable and so that they can be more promotable. But speaking of maintenance techs and assistants, it's way worth the money to spend. And I don't like to talk about people as, oh, I'm spending money on them. But rather than trying to save...
You're reinvesting into the growth of the business. At the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all a people business, and everyone knows that. And rather than spending $20 an hour on a make ready or a maintenance tech who doesn't have an EPA and can't work on HVACs, why not get someone for $22 an hour who has that ability and can work on HVACs with your maintenance supervisor, right? It's just trying to cut costs on the payroll side is the worst place on your P&L to try to cut expenses. And so one of my missions as we're doing all this restructuring efforts is I want to have the highest paid teams in the multifamily industry, you know, for our geographies. And I also want to have 75% of our staff living on site. So it's not just me getting a free apartment. I'm trying to get everyone else discounted or free apartments depending on their position and their needs.
Man, we experience that quite heavily. And then you have this separate, you know, rent roll to manage. And so I'm just curious. So we had that, the team member side of the leases going to HR, and it got to be too much. So we had to split that out amongst our regionals to manage those. Who, just out of curiosity, because it's one of these things that no one would ever ask, but it's just, I'm like geeking out. Who's managing the team member leases internally in the organization?
our asset managers are managing that. And then we also have a...
So they're signing lease. That's great, though, to get the asset managers signing leases and getting comfortable with the actual work that gets done. That's smart. Yeah.
We're taking a pretty radical approach to asset management because we're basically asking our asset managers to be...
Do some work. Don't just sit back behind a keyboard, you punk.
Be regional managers on top of an asset manager. We want them to...
I love it.
Understand what it means to think and act like a community manager, like a regional manager. And that way, there's just so much more meaning behind working in the spreadsheet.
Well, they have to get their hands dirty, right?
I mean, yeah, baby, yeah.
I mean, like, you could sit behind the spreadsheet, but if you have never talked to a resident, if you've never walked into a unit, if you've never seen costs between a $300 ceiling fan and a $100 ceiling fan, if you've never dealt with customer experience or the customer journey, you've never sat in an office where the community executive officer is sitting there and a resident comes in and that officer doesn't stand up, the asset manager can understand that this is truly
Gino just fired a dude for that.
No,
didn't know who he was. We walked
very
in
interesting. Jake and I were just, I came up to Knoxville on a Friday to do some videoing, and the plane got delayed. Airlines just suck over the last 6 months. We almost got delayed. I had to fly to Asheville same day. Then they decided to open the runway. I get there 2 hours late. We go on the property. We walk into the property. They don't know who we are. Friday afternoon, dude sitting down in his chair like this. I'm like, hey, brother, what I'm saying? I own this effing place. I got really annoyed.
Gino starts flipping tables. You think Hulk Hogan went nuts in that Trump speech?
It's just brother, you want to get off the saloons, brother? And it's not just because I'm the owner. It's because if I'm a customer and you're sitting down, I was taught as a young child to get up off your ass, shake somebody's hand. You never sit down. And that goes to anybody when you're in an office. And I didn't say anything, and I could see some steam coming out of Jake's ears. So after we left the office, we went in front of the pool. We were shooting our little videos, looking good back out there. Jake's like, yep, that's done. He's gone. So it's very interesting. He blames me.
If we're getting treated like that, I mean, can you imagine what a prospective resident is? So.
Yes, I agree.
Any recent challenges coming out of 2023? Any crazy insurance stories, floating rate debt, taxes going nuts, no longer getting 20% year-over-year rent growth, all the things that we saw, anything that you guys are up against that you're kind of managing through?
Yeah, I'll take all of the above. I think the game right now is certainly on hard mode. Not that it was necessarily on easy mode before, but
you're riding a wave, right? Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of challenges in the market, and our assets in Texas are no different. We are fortunate to only have one bridge loan in our portfolio, so we're able to manage that along. And otherwise, we're in very good shape. So we're blessed and we're very fortunate, and we're going to be able to, and have already been able to, take advantage of the change in the market rather than sitting back and licking our wounds too badly. So that's just a really big blessing. But still, nevertheless, we've been beat up like everyone else as far as rising insurance costs. The floating rate debt issue is certainly there. And to your point, Jake, as well, on rising rents. I mean, we are lucky to be in primary markets in Texas where rent growth is still positive, but it's not like what it used to be, right? So you're fighting tooth and nail, and you're trying to work on your renewals and retain your residents, and not just flippantly, oh yeah, let's just spend $6,000-$8,000 on a unit renovation and just bank on a rent increase. Now you have to be a lot more focused, a lot more careful, and and just kind of preserve cash if you're in a situation where that's necessary.
Tighten it up a little bit for sure. Anything exciting that the firm's going through right now? Anything that you want to share with the audience that you're pumped about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be excited about. I think, and I'm sure you guys have heard this a bunch, where you're talking to investors and they'll say, well, have you been through a cycle? Are you cycle tested and stuff like that, right? Well, it's happening right now. This is the proving grounds for all of us. And I'm super excited to have this opportunity and to get through this quote unquote cycle and take advantage of it as well. So I think it's just, we're gaining a ton of experience, and the market's going to get back to that wave and exciting, and everyone's going to want to invest and buy and sell, and it's going to be a crazy time, and people are going to be making money and stuff like that. So that time will come. But right now is the time that we prepare and we build the right systems, we build the right team, and so on and so forth. So I'm just super excited about that. We're investing, like I mentioned before, in our people. And so this week, the reason why I'm in New York is because we're here doing a culture index workshop, which is something I'm pretty passionate about. Didn't realize I was, but it's all about assessing people's capabilities, their personality, and matching who they are from a personality perspective to the job and making sure that you have the right people in the right seats. So it's kind of all in line with this bigger picture of top grading. I don't know if you guys have heard of that concept in that book, but that's something that
you going through. Are you going through like scaling up right now or something, or are you doing EOS or something?
No, not doing any EOS, but we're big believers in top grading. So we've been implementing top grading best practices, and then Culture Index marries with top grading.
Top
really
grading
well.
Is interesting. It's just sometimes it slows the decision-making process down in terms of when you're competing for a candidate. That's the only issue that I've ever had with it, but definitely if you got the bandwidth to do the work, it's impressive. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hiring people, I'll just finish on this note. Hiring people is probably the most important skill, right? Because in top grading, and other people cite the statistics that hiring for an A player, you're only successful 25% of the time. So that's a pretty low batting average. And if we can get that to flip to 75% of the time, that just makes life easier on all fronts, because there's nothing better than having A players on your side who are going and just doing things that you couldn't even dream of, and they're just making things happen.
Yeah, no, I do believe that, like, those Steve Jobs quotes, whatever they may be, it basically, to summarize it, it's you get enough A players on the team, you weed out the bad people, amazing things will happen, and sometimes you just got to get out of the way. Like, there is some amazing, and I've seen it at times, we haven't always hit, and we're not always there from like an executive team perspective, if you will. But when you are able to filter out the ones that don't fit, and you have all A players on the bus, it is pretty amazing, the feel of the team, the results that can happen. It's keeping it there and being able to identify quick enough to pluck somebody when you need to and replace. So no, I do believe in that. Okay. You're talking market cycle. The top of the market was what year, in your opinion?
The top of the market was late 2022, early 23.
Okay. So we'll say,
I'm sorry. Late 21, early 22.
So we'll call it 22 just for, okay.
Q1 22.
Where are we at right now?
Well, to talk a little economics, we are at the beginning of the easing cycle. The Fed is going to cut rates in September, let's say, and then they're going to begin a series of cuts. And historically speaking, when the Fed starts cutting is pretty much when we start having a recession. So from a broad-based economy standpoint, I think there's going to be quite a bit of a slowdown from a labor market perspective, from a consumer spending perspective.
So you're saying early bottom right now is where we're at.
Yes. And then when you talk about from a real estate standpoint, so the real economy has yet to bottom, and that's because the real economy is the last thing that moves, right? When the cycle changes, the stock market reprices instantly. Interest rates are moving pretty much instantaneously. Real estate is a bit of a laggard because of the nature of real estate. It's a slower moving beast. Transactions take a lot of time. There's human friction involved. So the real estate market lags about a year. And so
you're also having certain markets with supply issues because people are clinching on to those tight-fisted rates, right? Like, they don't want to let those low rates go, so they don't want to sell. I'm not saying every market, but I know certain markets, that's definitely the case.
Yeah. I mean, if someone doesn't have to sell that day, then why would they sell, right? They're going to hang on. They're going to try to drag and kick the can, right? Whereas in the stock market, there's a bit more of a emotional and capitulation, right? So if people are feeling negative about news or the change in dynamics, right, they'll sell off that stock. So the stock will reprice much faster than the way real estate. So real estate obviously has already experienced a repricing. And I do believe the assets that you guys and we're buying, these 2000s and newer vintage assets, I think those have already bottomed. So from a real estate perspective, I think there's still an opportunity there, but I think the bottom in opportunity, the bottom in pricing is already pretty much happening.
It's upon us?
It's already happened.
Well, it's not gone though.
It's not gone. No, it's not gone. But I think the perfect time to have purchased like 2000s and 2010 vintage assets was probably December and January, because there was no activity. There was no buyers in sight. Very much a lot of uncertainty.
You
with
think there's more competition rates now than there was a few months ago? Yeah.
Do you guys feel that?
Not really. Not yet.
It depends. No, no, Jake. It depends on
if you have a great too. Depends.
Yeah, it depends if you have a great relationship with brokers and they want to bring a deal to you.
We're picking up stuff off market right now. That's like pocket listings. So it's not. We haven't necessarily been competing. So it's hard to say.
And a lot of these assets, they can't be sold for what they were sold 2 years ago because rents really are lower. I mean, even though, I mean, you know, one of the assets is 12.2 and I think the appraisal came in at over 13 million. It's not even worth 13 mil based on what the income is right now. So that's part of the issue. You know, you're buying on, you know, you're buying on actuals, but you're, you know, borrowing on the pro forma. You're buying on, you understand what I'm saying? It's really difficult to actually buy these assets. So I think for us, we just got really lucky because these assets were off market and brokers are like, hey, you've got an opportunity here. And we gave them a fair offer. And understanding the motivation of the seller is also important. These sellers wanted to sell. They're motivated to sell, to your point where you were actually saying, hey, you know what? If you don't have to sell, you don't sell. But these sellers actually have to sell as well.
Yeah. And people intuitively can understand the simple idea of buy low, sell high. But the actual practice of it is so difficult because in a moment like this, that seller's not going to sell to anyone, right? You guys have spent years building the relationship such that they will pick you guys as the buyer for that deal in this time. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The price might be right, but debt is hard right now. And the income isn't, like you said, it's not where it should be. So your loan terms aren't going to be quite as attractive. So there's never an easy time to buy and you just have to keep plugging away and make it all happen.
That's the truth. Have you read anything in the last year or two that's added value to your life that you want to share with the folks?
Yeah, I've mentioned Top Grading. That's a great book. I'm on my second read through right now. Trying to think of some of the other recent books I've read. Definitely have read some good stuff, but I'll highly recommend Top Grading to anyone who is in the business of hiring and managing people because it's kind of like
call those references
a little bit. Yeah, call those references because I'm a lazy guy, right? And I don't want to call references. I just want to hire someone and be done.
Well, because they're not going to answer the first time, and the follow up is you know that's the devil in the details, right? You got to follow up, and then you know can you get them comfortable enough to tell you the truth? It's not easy. So
right, that's exactly right.
All right, Gino, that's it for me. You're up, big guy.
Well, before we get up to me, Rob, where can the listeners get a hold of you?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of me and learn more about us at Lone Star Capital is to head to our website, lscre.com. On our website, you can find everything more about our business strategy, as well as free downloads such as our underwriting model, passive investor guide, and links to the two books that I've published as well.
You got a young Rob Beardsley growing up in California. His parents are residential brokers, so he already has the real estate bug. He decides to go to Pittsburgh to go to school. He meets his business partner, Kenny P, in New York.
Kenny P.
And Kenny P and Rob are starting to do business. Say, you know, they're not, you know, they embrace the 10X and Grant Cardone. I'm not going for 21 unit. I am going for 260 plus, bro. On my first deal, ow. 2018, they smash it with a little bit of prayer, a little bit of, you know, luck. They pull through. And they sell the deal after 3 years. They get their first full cycle deal done. And they decide, you know what, let's continue to buy these assets. Now, you know, what's interesting is at 800 units, he decides, Rob does, that let's bring this property management in-house. And I love the whole evolution of the story of going out there, just becoming maybe a syndication company by just buying some deals and not really understanding investor relations to all of a sudden, I need to implement buy right, finance right, and manage right. And ultimately, Rob Beardsley's here to make multifamily great again.
G-Daddy for the win.
Thanks, Rob.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for that.
All right, guys. As always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy. And we make it happen. Make multifamily great again. I love it. We'll see you guys next time.
Thanks, Rob.